Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Well, a very important conversation is being had about the lack of diversity in the newsrooms. This is a conversation that we have been having for decades in this country. So what does it look like for Native journalists? According to 2017 data from the American Society of News Editors, less than 0.05% of all journalists at leading U.S. newspapers and online publications are Native American. Even though these numbers are still shamefully low, Native and Indigenous journalists are changing the media landscape in big ways. Today, we will talk with them about how they assess coverage of issues like COVID in Indian country, the toppling of statues, racist sports names, the hashtag land back conversation happening on social media, and tribal sovereignty. Today, we are joined by three guests. Connie Walker is an award-winning investigative reporter. Connie previously hosted the acclaimed CBC News podcast, Missing and Murdered. In 2018, Missing and Murdered Finding Cleo won the inaugural Best Serialized Story Award at the Third Coast International Audio Festival. Connie Walker recently joined Gimlet Media in New York City and is developing a new podcast that will be out later this year. Connie is Cree from the Okanis First Nation in Saskatchewan. Hi, Connie. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Jordan Bennett Begay. Jordan is a Diné citizen and Washington editor of Indian Country Today. The Native American Journalists Association is hosting Covering COVID-19 in Indian Country Navajo Nation Roundtable on July 23rd, and Jordan Bennett Begay will be speaking at that roundtable, and we have a link on our website, yourcallradio.org. Hi, Jordan. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Yaka Rose. I'm glad to be back.
Great to have you back. Kristen Atone is a member of the Kiowa tribe and serves as the Texas Observer's pretty new editor-in-chief and is president of the Native American Journalists Association. Previously, Tristan was the Indigenous Affairs editor at High Country News and has reported for many outlets, including NPR. Hi, Tristan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have all of you. And as we always do, or usually do, on our media roundtable, we like to start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Connie, let's start off with you. What grabbed your attention this week?
I actually just started listening to a podcast called American Rehab that was done by Reveal. I've just started it in the last, but I've heard it recommended a couple of places on the internet this week. And the first episode definitely has me hooked, so I'd recommend people check that out. And I'm a little bit behind on this, but I'm listening to the podcast Wind of Change as well, which is something that I wouldn't have necessarily thought I would be interested in, but it's really great storytelling, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
I've never heard of that one. What's it about?
It's a writer for The New Yorker, Patrick O'Keefe, and he is basically, it's kind of like a serialized podcast that is asking the question, was the CIA behind this hit called Wind of Change, done by this German band called the Scorpions, that was kind of seen as an anthem for the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall? And he heard a rumor that the CIA was actually behind writing the song or creating the song in some way. And so this podcast is basically trying to answer that question, but also just a really interesting insight into how the CIA operates in foreign countries and how, what they may or may not have been doing during the Cold War, which, you know, again, that's not necessarily something I would consider my wheelhouse, but it is really great storytelling.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. So that's the Wind of Change podcast, and then Reveal launching their first serialized investigation called American Rehab. Thank you for those, Connie. We'll put links at Your Call Radio after the show. What about you, Jordan? What caught your attention this week?
There was a wide range of stories happening this week, from the mascot issues to Remington Arms and the Navajo Nation. But I think what one story that really, with everything going on with the noise, I think one story that came out this week was an analysis by Mark Trahant, and he, you know, talked about, you know, who Joe Biden could consider, what three Native women could be considered for vice president for Joe Biden, and he highlighted that, you know, Peggy Flanagan, who is the lieutenant governor of Minnesota, should be considered, as well as Representative Deb Haaland of New Mexico could be, you know, one person to be considered. And the last one would be Val Davidson, and she was the Alaska's former lieutenant governor, and who she's now the president of Alaska Pacific University. So I think a large part of the conversation right now is, you know, considering Latina or Latinx women or Latin Latina woman or even Black woman. I think a lot of Native women, and now that we have more Native women running for public office too, you know, that's a huge part of the conversation that needs to be considered. And that could be found on our website too.
Great. Well, thank you. And I believe that we're going to get an announcement probably in the next couple of weeks, right around the beginning of August. Okay. Thank you for mm-hmm. that one, Jordan. What about you, Tristan? Mm-hmm. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be a little biased here, but I'm still over the moon about Elena Mejia Lutz's story, Neglected in Care, that ran in the Observer this week. It started before I came on as editor-in-chief, so I think I'm okay to be a little bit biased on this. Lutz essentially analyzed thousands of federal inspection reports, staffing ratios, and federal penalty data of more than 1,200 nursing homes in Texas. And she found that more than 1,800 dangerous incidents had been reported to federal regulators, which is significantly more than any other state, as well as she revealed kind of the legal abuse and exploitation of the state's nursing homes. So it's a powerful accountability journalism read, and really enjoyed diving into it this week.
So I just pulled it up, and it says this is inadequate staffing in for-profit Texas facilities, and this is leading to injuries and deaths.
That's correct.
Wow. Gosh, this is just happening all across the country. Well, thank you for that one. Neglected in Care from the Texas Observer. And we should say, Tristan, congratulations on your somewhat new job. You got the job just a couple months ago.
Yeah, that's correct. One of the best times of the year to start a new job.
And can you just talk about why you decided to move from High Country News over to the Texas Observer? I mean, it's a huge job. You're now their new editor-in-chief.
I was interested in continuing to do accountability and investigative journalism, which is primarily one of my large backgrounds, and obviously continuing to look at how we can expand indigenous coverage in Texas and beyond too. Really just seemed like a really great opportunity to be able to continue to learn and hone my skills as a reporter. It's exciting to helm a magazine.
Yeah. Well, and as I said, you know, this conversation around diversity in the media, it you hear it every year at the conferences, and, you know, some things change for sure. But I feel like this conversation is starting to sound a little bit different because a lot of people are going on social media and really talking about what they've endured at, you know, many mainstream publications. And I just wonder, Tristan, when it comes to Native and Indigenous reporters and Native and Indigenous issues, what are your thoughts about the conversation that's being had right now, especially around diversity in the media?
Well, it's obviously overdue. I'm skeptical that it will lead to any substantial changes in newsrooms. You know, when we're looking at sort of the trends that for-profit media organizations typically take, I mean, we're seeing, you know, 1% bumps or so in diversity year after year, even though it's been called for over 60 years, I believe, quite clearly. So, you know, despite having decades of advocacy and reports saying that diversity needs to change, that has obviously not happened at a large number of outlets. And while I see the conversation changing online, I do the cynical part of me wonders if whether or not this is just a, sort of a form of woke washing at a lot of these outlets. And maybe they're banking on this conversation dying down over the next 6 months to a year.
Jordan, what are your thoughts?
I've always been an advocate, of course, of diversity in newsroom, but not being like a checkbox, but also, you know, having, you know, people in leadership positions, because they can be, you know, at the lower level, but it's not until you have people of color in these leadership positions who are making, you know, the big decisions that I think change will really happen in newsrooms across the country.
And Connie, you have an interesting perspective on this because you lived in Canada and now you're in New York City. So what is the conversation that's happening in the U.S. around these issues look like to you as someone who lived in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that the conversations that are happening now, just in terms of Indigenous issues and better reflecting Indigenous stories in our communities, really in the United States feels like those conversations were happening, you know, 5 or 6 years ago in Canada. And I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, in terms of meaningful inclusion in media, Canada has been kind of doing some of this work for you know, a number of years now. That's not at all to say that the issues are not there and that there is not still huge problems in terms of the lack of diversity within newsrooms, specifically, I mean, around Indigenous inclusion as well. Although there have been, you know, some incredible shifts in the last 2 years in Canada around, you know, not just the number, the sheer volume of stories, which is you know, been transformative in a lot of ways, but the kinds of stories, I think that what that has actually done is actually helped kind of bring the issues that have always been there to the forefront. And so now people are speaking out about these really, really systemic issues that Indigenous people and Black Indigenous people of color journalists in newsrooms continue to face. And you know, I also agree it's long overdue. I totally agree with Jordan that it's not enough just to have, you know, these journalists in entry-level positions, that we need to be, you know, in managerial positions. But I think that is also, you know, there's ongoing issues, and this is going to take sustained effort over, you know, more than just a news cycle to actually reflect some meaningful change. And I think that, you know, that's something that obviously will be better, you know, for journalists, but it's going to result in better coverage and better representation. And I think that's really what's being lost here, is that without this meaningful change, without the people in the newsrooms to tell these stories, we're really doing a disservice to the public, you know, who want to know the truth about the realities of life in Indigenous communities, in particular in Canada and in the United States. And we're just starting to see that change.
It's interesting to hear you say that the conversations that are starting now in the U.S. are conversations that started in Canada about 5 years ago. What do you think explains that?
Well, in Canada, I mean, Canada is obviously a smaller country, and we have a very strong, national public broadcaster in the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. I worked at CBC, disclaimer, for 20 years, and I'm a huge champion of public broadcasting and a huge champion of the journalism that they do there. There obviously are still a ton of issues around diversity and inclusion at CBC, but I think that having a strong national public broadcaster really helped to kind of push some of that forward. So it was actually about 7 years ago that we started a digital-only kind of offering at CBC called then CBC Aboriginal, and it was basically a hub for all Indigenous content at the CBC. So whether it was on radio or television or online only, it was kind of aggregating all of that content and then pushing it out to an audience that we knew that was interested and that was online and was digital and hungry for these news. But I really think that a large part of that appetite and a large part of that audience was fueled by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is something that happened in Canada. You know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission actually traveled the country for 4 or 5 years, hearing from residential school survivors about their experience. And I'm not sure how much your audience is familiar with the residential school system in Canada, but for over 100 years, Indigenous kids were taken from their families and communities as children, some as young as 4 years old, and sent to these residential schools where they live for most of the year, if not all of the year, in some cases, away from their family and community. And the goal of those, the goal of that system was actually to assimilate Indigenous kids, to take, quote, the Indian out of the child, unquote, and to really strip them of their language, culture, and Indigenous identity. And what that caused, obviously, was, just devastation among families and communities. And it was, it was decades before Canada really reckoned with that history. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the work that they did amplifying the stories of survivors of this system, I think really helped, was instrumental in helping to kind of start this awakening that's happened in Canada around, the unshared history that we have that has never been told. And that's something that, again, I see as, from my point of view, I'm obviously very new to the U.S. and I have a lot to learn, and I would love to hear Tristan and Jordan's thoughts on this, but it feels like that reality and those realities and those truths and that history is just starting to be told here in a really meaningful way and breakthrough in mainstream media. And it's long overdue, but it's exciting to even get to be a small part of it.
Hmm. Yeah. Tristan, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is definitely a different history here in terms of how the United States has dealt with its past. And I think that in the way that there has been almost no recognition of the U.S.'s past, that's obviously informing relationships with media. There are it's newsrooms that seem to be sort of organs of the state and often seem to be invested to some degree in Indigenous dispossession. I think that we see like Indigenous people in the U.S. treated as more of entertainment for reporters, not necessarily seen as legitimate sources or areas for journalists to be working. When we look at when we look at for-profit mainstream newsrooms, they're routinely wrong in their coverage of Indian country. They're routinely wrong in their journalism. They're routinely wrong in their takes, their research, and they absolutely refuse to hire Indigenous people in any form whatsoever, or have diversity at the top levels of organization to help steer this kind of coverage. And the fact that I think most U.S. citizens lack any sort of basic education as to the history of the United States in relation to Indigenous people compounds the problem, quite acutely. And I think we see that in journalism in some pretty horrible ways.
Right. Even as we're having a reckoning around race in this country and the true history of this country, listening to these conversations, unfortunately, unless an Indigenous person is really part of the conversation, based on what I've heard, it seems like Indigenous history is still really missing from these needed conversations.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if Connie and Jordan agree, but, one of the jokes I think we always have as Indigenous affairs reporters is that we're essentially doing the job that your public education system refused to or couldn't do.
Right. Jordan, why don't you jump in there? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree with Tristan. I know when I was a teacher, that was one of my main, I guess, focuses, like at the end of the academic year, was really teaching my students, and I taught video production and journalism, and I realized I had to teach the foundation, not only, it was like on Navajo and in New Mexico, but of the whole country, and a lot of students were just appalled and not learning, but there's also like some teachers who are really great allies and who are already headed in that direction, but it's the education system as a whole who are really opposed to it, and kind of like push back against students questioning it or even teachers questioning it as well. But it's just funny earlier when Tristan kept saying routinely mainstream media continues to get it wrong, but I completely agree with that. And I think, sometimes if these can't get into these newsrooms, like a lot of the time, I think a lot of people, from what I'm seeing, are just doing it ourselves, you know, and just kind of, you know, of course, tweeting out, like, saying mainstream, you need to do this wrong, be better, fix it. But a lot of us are looking to ourselves and to each other to be part of that solution, too. I mean, right now for, like, Indian Country Today, my editor, Mark Trahant, has been, really, in the past few years, wanting to create a national news broadcast. And now that's really happening right now, and it's always an improvement to be made. But a lot of it is just relying on ourselves and each other to push that conversation forward and creating those, you know, relationships.
And Connie, again, you're new to the U.S., living in New York. It seems like where we are right now, there are so many stories around indigenous issues in the mainstream. I mean, just doing some research last night, Medium, NBC, Columbia Journalism Review, lots of really great stories are coming out. At the same time, you've got, like, for example, the New York Times had a piece earlier this month, the fullest look yet at the racial inequity of coronavirus. And as so many people pointed out on Twitter, including Rebecca Nagel, host of the This Land podcast, the New York Times story doesn't include a single statistic or data point about the impact of COVID on Native Americans. I mean, I get press releases all the time about housing. You know, you name the issue, and Native Americans are almost always missing from the data. So on one hand, you've got natives really changing the media landscape. On the other hand, they're still missing from so many of these stories.
Yeah, I think that it just shows, obviously, the amount of work that is left to do, that although there is this kind of awakening and there is this kind of, you know, resurgence around telling our own stories and amplifying our voices and getting some of these issues out there, that there is still, a huge problem in terms of just the lack of representation in data, in mainstream media, in so many aspects. And I what you guys said about how using journalism to do the job of public education, that is definitely something that I feel like we are doing, that has become like my main job as a journalist, I feel like, in a lot of ways, because it's true, we weren't taught our own shared history in schools. We didn't learn about residential schools or boarding schools or treaties or land claims issues or any of those things within the public education system. And I think journalism is actually an amazing tool at helping people to understand. And I'm a journalist. I mean, I've been a journalist for 20 years. I started at CBC in 2000, back when, you know, there really was the only time Indigenous people were in the news was when there was some kind of terrible conflict or crisis. And it has really taken, you know, that long for there to be this level of interest. And I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, we are still, like, kind of limited by the kinds of stories that we can tell within mainstream news and within kind of the constraints of those platforms. You know, I worked a lot in TV where you have, like, a two-minute news story or a minute and a half sometimes, or, you know, we're all struggling for seconds on social media. In terms of even, you know, time spent reading an article. And for me, you know, I think podcasting has become, you know, really feels like the ideal platform to explore a lot of these stories and issues, because you can kind of delve into the nuance and delve into the context, which I think when you're missing that public education piece around Indigenous people and issues, that is so important. And that's something that, you know, that's why, you know, I essentially left mainstream news and mainstream journalism, daily news anyway, to focus full-time on podcasting.
Hmm. Connie Walker is an award-winning investigative reporter. As she said, she started at the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, in 2000. She hosted the acclaimed podcast Missing and Murdered. She recently joined Gimlet Media in New York City and is developing a new podcast that will be out later this year. Jordan Bennett Begay is Washington editor of Indian Country Today, and she's going to be taking part in a roundtable discussion covering COVID in Indian Country on July 23rd at 1 p.m. Pacific time. It'll be on Zoom. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. Tristan Attone serves as Texas Observer's new editor-in-chief and is president of the Native American Journalist Association. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we are talking about how Native and Indigenous journalists are changing the media landscape. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about how Native and Indigenous journalists are changing the media landscape. Today, we're joined by Connie Walker. Connie started at the CBC in 2000 and hosted the podcast Missing and Murdered. She recently joined Gimlet Media in New York and is developing a new podcast that will be out later this year. Jordan Bennett Begay is Washington editor of Indian Country Today, and Tristan Attone serves as the Texas Observer's new editor-in-chief. He's president of the Native American Journalists Association. Previously, Tristan was Indigenous Affairs editor at High Country News. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, if you'd like to talk about the state of Native media and what really stands out for you in Native and mainstream media, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Tristan, just one more question about just the media landscape today. I mean, it does get tiring. We hear that all the time about the need to call out these outlets, but it is so important. NPR releases their diversity stats every year, and every year I write them and say, how can you not include Native numbers in your stats? Well, in February, they actually had an entire article about this, and here's how it starts. Late last year, many listeners and readers rightly objected when NPR released statistics tracking the diversity of its on-air sources and didn't include a category for Native or Indigenous sources because the numbers were so low. So they had a whole story on here looking at, you know, how they need to change this. They looked at their coverage. But it really took people calling them out for this.
Yeah, that's true. And I think those call-outs continue. I mean, to Jordan's point, you know, she's absolutely right here in that there are alternatives to mainstream or for-profit media. You know, Indian Country Today is a great example. You know, I think that beyond the sort of idea of calling out, I do think that we need to start having a more robust conversation about how you hold media organizations accountable. I would argue that until those outlets actually diversify their staff, you know, subscribers, supporters, philanthropists, private foundations, you know, that are invested in fair representation and accurate reporting should divert funds from those operations to ones that actually do. This is obviously working right now when it comes to the ideas of defunding the police. And I do think that similar tactics can work in the news world. If you care about what the diversity in your newsroom and how folks go about doing it, you know, supporting the folks that do it right and have been trying to do it right and are making those actions is the way to go.
Yeah, it's a great question. How do you hold them accountable?
I mean, it's the money, right? I mean, you know, if you don't diversify your staff, we're going to cut your money. Then, like, that's how it works. You know, the large, you know, NPR is a great example of pulling in some fairly substantial, you know, philanthropy support. Those philanthropists have a say in what NPR's diversity looks like and can make substantial changes, you know, by putting some strings on that cash. You know, I mean, that's how funding works a lot of the times. And I think that there is an opportunity for folks to actually take those moves and hold those folks accountable.
What are your thoughts on this, Connie? Because it seems like you really got some major support from the CBC for your podcast.
Well, I mean, that took a long time to actually manifest. And I think that what Tristan's saying is around, you know, using your money in terms of your advocacy is really important. But even at organizations like the CBC, which is a public broadcaster whose mandate is to accurately reflect and cover its community, which obviously includes, you know, hundreds of Indigenous nations across the country, Indigenous First Nations across the country, Inuit populations in the North, and Métis as well. You know, we weren't always very, very good at doing that. And it actually, you know, it took, you know, even though that was always part of CBC's mandate, that was always raised in, as an issue from the time I started at CBC, there was, you know, a yearly kind of conversation about, like, how do we improve our diversity? How do we improve our numbers? And I would say that it wasn't until we actually proved for them that there was an audience that was interested in this content, that there were people, there were, you know, not just Indigenous people in Canada, but also Canadians who were interested in these stories, who wanted to know more, and that these people were actually hungry for more nuanced conversations and more nuanced coverage, that they actually started shifting and prioritizing this coverage. Like, I remember one of the first stories that I did, and it would have been back in, like, 2015, for the National, which is the national newscast for CBC, about an Indigenous, it was an Indigenous-focused story. And I remember calling into the desk and speaking to the assignment editor about my story, and he said, "Oh, you know what? We already have an Indigenous story on tonight, so we're going to hold yours until tomorrow." Like, you know, the idea being that you can't have more than one. Like, that was just going to be too much. Mm-hmm. And exactly a year later, I was covering the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Ottawa, and it led the national newscast for 5 nights in a row. And on the night that the final report was released, the whole first 15 minutes of the entire show was all Truth and Reconciliation and all Indigenous coverage. And that shift happened in 1 year, and it happened because of the shift to digital, because CBC was placing more emphasis on the digital metrics, and for the first time, you know, we actually could hear directly from our audience about some of this coverage, and that's what they wanted to hear. And I think that that's what made the case, not that people finally realized, oh, these are actually important stories. It was like, here it is in your face. It's undeniable that there is an audience for this, and we need to keep investing in it. And I think that, unfortunately, that's what actually, you know, then, you know, led to support for projects like the Missing and Murdered Project we did at CBC, which then eventually, years later, led to the podcast. So, you know, it's unfortunate that it requires, you know, that kind of convincing, but it does sometimes, and I think that hopefully that's shifting and changing, but there's obviously so much more work to do.
And your podcast has been downloaded about 10 million times, is that right?
I don't have accurate numbers because I'm no longer at CBC, but when I left, it was over 30 million times.
30 million, and I think wow.
Our podcast is called Missing and Murdered, and it focuses on violence against Indigenous women and girls, and I think that part of the reason for its popularity is that it's considered a true crime podcast, and we very much, you know, do focus on, you know, one unsolved case of an Indigenous woman or girl who's been missing or who has been murdered, and we help their families try to find out the truth about what happened to their loved one. And so, you know, I think that we've been able to kind of hopefully subvert some of the popularity that the true crime genre has right now. And our aim is to really, you know, obviously help families and really try to help them find a resolution about their loved one, but really also to tell a bigger story about, you know, the disproportionate rates of violence Indigenous women and girls face, but also what that means for families and communities, and what are the bigger issues that are at play in some of these statistics, and really helping to try to, you know, to create space for people to have empathy and connections, and using kind of that narrative storytelling to do that with people in communities that, you know, have been for far too long totally underrepresented in media and in all forms, journalism and movies and books and everything, but also who have been misrepresented. And I think that the stereotypes that exist around Indigenous people make that even more difficult sometimes. And so what our podcast tries to do is really kind of cut through all of that, and we're so lucky that we can focus on one story and really help people hopefully understand, you know, the bigger story about Indigenous people and Indigenous communities in North America.
And you can find more about the podcast Missing and Murdered at yourcallradio.org. Connie Walker recently joined Gimlet Media in New York City and is developing a new podcast that will be out later this year. We're also joined today by Jordan Bennett Begay, Washington editor of Indian Country Today, and Tristan Autone, Texas Observer's editor-in-chief and president of the Native American Journalists Association. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're talking about how Native and Indigenous journalists are changing the media landscape, even though the number of Native journalists in mainstream publications continues to be shamefully low. Jordan, what about Indian Country Today? Unfortunately, because of COVID, so many media outlets are cutting staff. The Guardian just yesterday announced that about 70 people on their editorial staff will be let go. I mean, it's nonstop. What is happening at Indian Country Today in terms of, you know, just your solvency and your funding and what's to come in the next year?
And fortunately, I think everybody, like you said, is shrinking, and the opposite is happening for us. We're actually growing. We had a couple of people come on board. One correspondent, Mary Annette, came on board. And we actually started our broadcast, our newscast now during the pandemic, as just a way to inform our communities overall. And we were also, that's showing on FNX, so we partnered with them, and we also have a primetime spot with Arizona PBS right now, and it continues to grow, and it's something we share on social media. And also we share that audio and the shows with tribal news stations, and it's all in the form of, you know, keeping in mind that we are a public servant, and this information is really critical for our audience and just for Indian Country overall. I think what I really like about the organization is we're very experimental and always learning and trying new things and seeing if it works, and if it doesn't, how can we be better? How can we be innovative? And I think that's what this pandemic has been pushing us, you know, in that direction. And it's been working out, you know, very well, at least on our end, really using new technologies and seeing what equipment we can use, and working from home like everybody else during this time.
And you're, like I said, you're going to be on a roundtable discussion about COVID and Indian Country on July 23rd at 1 o'clock Pacific time. We've had you on a couple of shows about COVID and Indian Country, Jordan. Can you give us a quick update? I was watching some videos yesterday, and it looks like the curve is starting to flatten on the Navajo Nation, but it's still really bad.
Yeah, it is. I mean, across the country, I mean, they're, from what I've seen, because we've been collecting data for over 4 months right now. I mean, it's, of course, it needs to be comprehensive. There's a lot of nuances to that. But from what I am seeing right now, the tribal nations that were hit very early on, like the Navajo Nation, or even like the White Mountain Apache, like a lot of their cases are, you know, slowing down a bit, but they're still trickling in. And the tribes that were hit later on the pandemic, they're seeing spikes in their cases. And particularly for tribes that are near, like, the metro areas, such as Phoenix, Arizona, a lot of the tribes that are in the, you know, near Phoenix are seeing a spike in cases. And I haven't gotten, you know, to talk to tribal leaders there to see what's going on, but at least for, I think it was Gila River, a lot of their cases are from non-Gila River members who live outside the reservation. So at least to me, that makes me question if people are still continuing to travel, and I don't know if they're following precautionary measures or not. But even just the data overall is something we're trying to work toward and create a more comprehensive database. Just recently, we also partnered with Johns Hopkins University to make that happen, and we're working with students who are volunteering there and with one of the more student journalism students in Oklahoma, also in Colorado, to reach out to tribes, because it is very we're trying to respect tribal sovereignty in this data collection, because tribes are the ones making that decisions if they want to release the data or not. And we're also reaching out to tribal health facilities, too, because a lot of the Indian health system is our health facilities that are owned and operated by tribes. And it's about, from what I last remember, about 83% of the Indian health system are clinics run by tribes. And then the other, like, 17% are direct service facilities. And so when you think about data, a huge chunk of it is missing, because the 17% of direct service facilities that are IHS are required to report data. But the other, like, 83% of those tribally run clinics, they can, you know, are encouraged to give the data to IHS, but they don't have to. But even a huge part of that data is still missing. And there's just so many nuances that I think a lot of mainstream media doesn't understand about it. They think that, you know, IHS is the sole, you know, health care provider for Indian country, and that's not the case. Like, you have to think about purchase health care, Medicaid, private providers, urban Indian health, like, where do they go to get tested? And I think that's what a lot of the, you know, the hit and miss is happening in mainstream right now. And also the case of, like, border towns and that racial misclassification during the pandemic.
Yeah, and Tristan, context is so important. The last time we had Jordan on the show, we talked about how the mainstream are reporting that one out of three Navajo families do not have running water, but there was little to no context about how that's directly connected to broken treaties. So there's just so much here. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you often get the, I mean, this has happened for decades, the poverty and, you know, lack of running water. But the broken treaties segment of this, Tristan, which is so incredibly important, is often missing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that I tend to think that that's willful ignorance by reporters to just not look at the legal history of the areas that they're reporting in. You know, I mean, again, I think this speaks to the idea of holding news organizations accountable. I mean, it's important to hold these organizations accountable in the reporting, because we are a profession that's built on trust and accuracy. And I guess my question is, if these newsrooms are getting this much wrong this often on this beat, like, what else are they getting wrong? Like, how can I trust the New York Times or the Washington Post are doing accurate coverage on the president when they can't accurately cover a story on the Navajo Nation? I mean, these are serious questions about our profession. Mm. And the fact that these continue to be ignored, I think, speak volumes about where our profession is and likely where it's going.
Mm. Connie, what would you add to that? Do we still have Connie? Connie, are you still with us?
Oh. Sorry about
okay.
that.
That's okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, as a relative newcomer to the United States, I feel like what I've been feeling in the last few months, just kind of reading some of that mainstream coverage that Tristan points out, you know, is often not providing the accurate picture or the full picture of the history of these communities, is how much, you know, how different, even though there are so many similarities between Canada and the United States in terms of our shared history and the impacts of colonialism on Indigenous communities in particular, there are so many differences, and there is so much that I have yet to learn about, you know, the history of treaties in the United States, the history of colonization, and how it's continued to impact, you know, communities on both sides of the border, but particularly in the United States around COVID and around some of these you know, crises that are continuing to impact communities. But I think that you know, in terms of his point about, you know, trusting journalists and journalism organizations to tell the truth about, you know, any issue or any coverage when they're not able to accurately reflect things like, you know, how COVID is impacting Indigenous communities is a really important point. And I think, again, it's kind of comes full circle and speaks to the lack of representation in these newsrooms and what is the New York Times doing in terms of trying to recruit and then after that, or NPR or any of these mainstream organizations, which obviously, like, organizations like Indian Country Today are really, really incredibly important and should be supported as well. But we need to be doing, like, those organizations that are going to be covering Indigenous stories need to be doing a better job of bringing in Indigenous journalists and developing them and retaining them. And those are not something, you know, that can be fixed overnight, but we need to ensure that they're at least doing the bare minimum and making that an effort to rectify some of these terrible situations.
Right. Well, and to this point, Tristan, can you tell us more about this project? Earlier this year, Report for America and the Native American Journalists Association partnered to support 19 journalists over the next year.
So Report for America places reporters all around the country in newsrooms, usually sort of early career reporters, sometimes mid-career, to create jobs and get more coverage in areas that may not be seeing coverage or even have news deserts for that matter. And we've been working at NAJA, we've been working with Report for America to, create more Indigenous affairs positions. That means hiring more Native people. That also means training non-Indigenous people on how to do this kind of coverage. We see this, the Indigenous Affairs Desk has been really, really picking up over the last couple of years, and I think we're all heartened to see that. The question is when they become, relatively common in the entire industry. But it's a start. And I think that even having folks in places and in communities that have traditionally not had a reporter there that was focused on their, people, politics, and places, it's important to have that initiative going and be supported. But again, I think when I'm looking at sort of the entire news ecosystem, nowadays, I tend to shy away from, again, those for-profit media organizations. I think the action and the future is in, nonprofit media. It's in small newsrooms and local newsrooms that are hosting Indigenous affairs positions, and it's in Indigenous media outlets across. There are more than 200 different Indigenous news outlets operating around the U.S. and more in Canada, more in Mexico, just across the region. And it's a really rich area of coverage and places that most reporters don't, usually go, especially right. If they're coming off the coast.
Yeah. Final thoughts from all of you. Like I said, it's such an interesting time because on the one hand, you have so many amazing stories being told and, Native writers are publishing in very mainstream publications. At the same time, you have Trump, and I got to say, I was really shocked. I shouldn't be shocked, but I was. When he mentioned Manifest Destiny, when he was at Mount Rushmore, I did not hear one reporter, I should say mainstream reporter, take that piece out of his speech, which in simplistic terms is basically Native genocide. So you've got that happening. You also have these statues being toppled. Columbus here in California, Junipero Serra, and the missions, there's so much educating being done around this. And then people talking about, the founding of the country and not going any further than that. I mean, Native genocide, but let's go even further and talk about the languages that were spoken. I mean, just what this country was like, pre-colonization. I mean, there's just so much. And I just wonder, Jordan, as a young journalist working for Indian Country Today, how do you think about these issues and the role that you really want to play at this time?
I didn't even finish watching his speech because it got me so angry.
Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting time to be a journalist. Even, I know my sister texted me like earlier this week with everything going on, and she's like, what a time it is to be reporting. And oftentimes I have to think about, as a young Navajo woman, like why I'm doing this for my community and why it's so needed, right? I want to tell these accurate stories and create, alliances with other non-Native journalists so they can do it right. Because oftentimes, a lot of our own people don't look to our news coverage, sadly, but even though we work for them and a lot of them, these mainstream stories are really working. So I think, trying to be very diplomatic about it, but also strong about it. And, you know, reaching out to, if there's some type of wrong, reaching out to the actual reporter and, you know, seeing what was going through their mind or what was behind their decisions they're making. I think it's just an opportunity for me just to be, you know, stand my ground and, like I said, just reach out to other Indigenous journalists for support during this time. And I think the last point is just, I think I always try to keep in mind that journalism was created by white men. And so with that, you know, the whole narrative is that there is this one normal narrative, and it's about, you know, dominant culture, and we're like a, I don't know, non-dominant culture part of that, so we're seen as biased, and there's that fear of if they probably want to hire Indigenous journalists, they're going to be biased, whereas everybody's a biased objectivity, you know, is something we can all strive for, but it's not perfect, but we can be fair in that way. So I think that's a, you know, a big fear of mainstream outlets overall.
Tristan, what would you add? We have about 30 seconds.
In regards to sort of reporters ignoring those points in that history, I mean, it's a form of Holocaust denial. That's all there is to it. Journalists are engaging in a form of Holocaust denial. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with Jordan that the idea of journalism is a Western concept to some degree. But I would push back on this idea of changing the landscape. I'd argue that what we're doing is inviting newsrooms to reexamine their journalism traditions and goals and embrace a different vision of what the profession is and can be from an Indigenous perspective.
And Connie, 30 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is such an amazing time to be an Indigenous journalist because there's finally this widespread recognition that our stories matter, they are important, people need to know about them. And I totally agree with Jordan and Tristan just around this idea, this fallacy in journalism of objectivity. And I hope that there's an understanding that as Indigenous journalists who have lived experience in our communities, that actually, you know, bolsters and helps our reporting, the fact that, you know, we have personal connections to our families and our communities, and that's what's motivating our work. Is something that should be held up and celebrated and welcomed. And I hope that these conversations that are happening lead to journalism becoming a more welcoming space for Indigenous journalists, because we really need more people out there telling our own stories and amplifying our own voices from our communities.
Connie Walker, Jordan Bennett-Begay, and Tristan Aton, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.